Welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. Let us help you escape your mind.
All right, folks, welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have episode number 201 today. We're going to be discussing the book Ghosts of Atlantis with the author Douglas Kenyon. Douglas is the author, as I mentioned, of this new book. He is also the publisher and editor of Atlantis Rising Magazine, and he is also the editor of Forbidden History. So you can go check out all those. I will put the links down below the video. If you're interested in the book, I have the link to Inner Traditions website down below so you can pick up a copy. I have my copy right here, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you for that. Before we get started, if everybody can head on over to our Patreon at patreon.com/mindescapepodcast for just $2 a month. You'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments. I don't know, maybe we can get Douglas to do one with us here at the end for a few minutes. And but yeah, if you're interested, tons of stuff on there. There's a whole catalog of other stuff that's not available on YouTube or any of our audio platforms, so go check that out. And one more thing, head on over to indrasweb.org. That is the social media platform that we created to connect open minds. So whether you're hypothesizing, theorizing, speculating, whatever, on all these interesting topics, whether it be ancient civilizations or ancient knowledge, you name it, that's the perfect place to do it. So head on over there and sign up for an account. But without further ado, welcome on Mind Escape, Douglas.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So I read your book, Ghosts of Atlantis, and really enjoyed it. There's a lot of stuff in there. Obviously, it's a pretty thick book. You kind of go through the whole range of things from Plato stuff to some of the more out there theories. And is this like a culmination of everything you were doing with the Atlantis Rising magazine? Is this kind of like your curated knowledge all put together?
Well, I think you could say that fairly. I wouldn't argue with that. When you end up after 25 years of collecting a lot of material on the hard drive, and you're looking for a way to get it out there. However, I would say that we were careful throughout to maintain a certain standard in terms of the evidence and in terms of the objectivity of the material we were looking at. And we were consistent on that score. So I thought that by assembling all of that in one place would be, I didn't think anybody had done that previously. There's certainly been a lot of good research on Atlantis from a lot of people, but they're not up to date in my view. And well, frankly, a lot of people have done a lot since we were there. Hmm. But at any rate, I think when you put it all together, if you have a point of view and you have a kind of a structure that you can maintain, and I think of like a pyramid, it is like a capstone type of event, and it kind of sums it up.
Absolutely. So, and like one of the main themes is obviously this idea of our lost our lost history, or we're a species with amnesia. I know that's pretty prevalent within Graham Hancock stuff as well. So why don't you talk a little bit about that, and then we'll get into where Atlantis, the idea of Atlantis, comes from.
Well, really, that's the theme that got me going way back in the beginning, with the realization that there had been episodes in history that had come and gone, and there was virtually no record of them. And yet, if you could look at things with a certain objectivity, you could sense they were there, they were present. So I wanted to talk about that, and I wanted to express that. The idea of amnesia really kind of crystallized for me around Emmanuel Velikovsky's book, Earth and Amnesia, which was really kind of a summary of things that he had done up to that point. But he was a psychiatrist, and he was looking at the idea that fact, the way he put it was that the psychological condition in case history of planet Earth is one of amnesia. And then subsequently, of course, a lot of people like Graham Hancock and a lot of others have picked up on the idea, because there really isn't anything that describes better the condition that we're in. And there are all kinds of consequences, ramifications for this condition that are seldom taken into account. I think the reason people have difficulty emotionally with approaching this subject is a product of amnesia and the effect that it has on us, the scarring that we've undergone.
Yeah, and I think he's probably most known for Worlds in Collision. That's what most people usually point to. But in terms of...
He's the father of catastrophism.
The idea
that we've been punctuated, history has been punctuated by these events that really account for all the kinds of things that we see.
So when you look at this, the younger Dryas impact hypothesis, is that when that came into I don't even know if it's even really mainstream yet, but it's been on Joe Rogan, you have Randall Carlson, Graham Hancock talking about these things, and actually a lot of people enjoying that topic. Is that something that you felt like then validated this idea, because it shows maybe there was, not even just more of like a global community or something, or people were getting around a lot more back in the day, and then this big, comet or, piece of a comet hits and kind of wipes everything out. And, around the time right after that, you have Göbekli Tepe and all these interesting things popping up. So was that kind of like validating to you for a lot of these theories and hypotheses?
Yeah, it was. I thought that there's been a lot of really significant research on the whole younger Dryas hypothesis. And probably the most important was that big discovery that they made in Greenland about 4 years ago, where they discovered that there's a huge impact crater underneath the glaciers there. Because up till then, people had said, and this is looking at the idea that Earth was hit by an object of some kind, and that's not the only viable approach. That Robert Schoch, for example, says it was a solar outburst. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, and there's plenty of evidence, people have looked at the idea that Earth got hit by some kind of object from space. But the criticism of that was that, well, if there was such an object, where's the crater? Where's the and there should be such a crater. And for a long time, there wasn't any crater that was sufficient to account for this. And then they made this, I would cite you chapter and verse on this, but it's the big discovery in Greenland specifically of this giant crater about several miles across that could account for a lot of this, and probably had a lot to do with the and there are other examples there are other events that all apparently occurred about the same time. And if there was a crater, it probably was not just one object, it was probably a whole series of objects that basically left their prints. And that's one of the things that we talk about in the book under the heading of the Carolina Bays. Every one of these that I bring up, I know it's not the only one that carries, that makes the point.
Yeah, there's definitely some debate too, because I know mainstream academics would point to the fact that they haven't been able to get a dating on that impact that's under the ice sheet in Greenland yet. So there's really no way to for sure point to a timeline, if is that correct?
Well, some may say that, but I frankly think the evidence is pretty strong that it was about it was certainly in that range of dates that we're talking about, a little over 12,000 years ago, and it corresponds with the Plato sinking of Atlantis and Göbekli Tepe and other sites that can be all tied to this one event. There's one very interesting study that was done by a Scottish group, but they were talking about evidence that they found or that they were able to deduce from looking at some cave paintings and elsewhere, showing that there was knowledge of the precession of equinoxes going back to this date and earlier. Now, the precession of the equinoxes, of course, is that's the big clock in the sky, so to speak, that basically breaks down the whole series of events that we're looking at and give us the scenario for a tragic history. And of course, this was looked at by in the 60s by the von Dusken and his his partner at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I'm talking about Hamlet's Mill, which is the basically describing
Giorgio de Santillana.
De Santillana, exactly. There you go. And if you guys aren't having senior moments that much yet, probably, I'm sure. But I hope you'll overlook some of mine.
We have brain farts too. I had a couple last night. So.
Absolutely.
But anyway, if you look at the unfolding of events in in the way the constellations move, the way the stars move, and so forth, and all of the tales that are attached to that, you start to see the stories. It becomes, you know, pretty clear that we've had this history that can be a story can be told. That, and this is really kind of that's the final chapter in the book. But I think it corresponds to the narrative that we're getting across, that we have this history on Earth that can't really be understood unless you can incorporate the kind of the tragic dimension into it. And you have to, and I think you have to make it a ghost story, because I think of the story of the what we're, if you look at a haunted house, you know, you're looking about, you know, you could say superstition aside or any of that, but just the idea that you have individuals who had dramatically traumatic experiences, and they're basically trapped in this I want to use the word matrix, or they're trapped in the situation of a particular place or time, and they're looking to be free or to escape from it, and they torment those who are present around them. And so that's kind of the archetype that I'm trying to get across you.
Yeah, it's almost like Rupert Sheldrake's morphic resonance or something like that.
Well, I think you can see it in those terms. And I think that, you know, in Hamlet, you have the Hamlet is haunted by the ghost of his father, who was murdered. And here Hamlet is surrounded by essentially those who murdered his father. And his father comes to him as a ghost, and basically is asking for to be avenged. he has this demand that he's making on the living. And I think that you can look at that as, I'm not trying to say these things are real,
right,
in any objective way, but they are certainly real psychologically. And they are real in terms of our the inner process that we go through as souls, as individuals who are basically climbing the mountain and working our way back to whatever it was that we left behind.
Hmm. Absolutely. To go back to, just to point out too, people don't know what precession is. We've talked about it a lot in the past, but it's also known as Plato's Great Year. It's the cycle of the stars. So like the constellations are not stationary. They move. I think it's 1 degree every 72 years in the sky. And a full cycle is about 25,800 years, roughly. So
this is because there's a wobble,
right,
in the Earth practice, though there is another possible explanation. But basically, it traces the pole, North Pole, traces a giant circle in the zodiac, around the zodiac, and so the constellation that is the rising constellation in Aries, or at the spring equinox, appears to move backwards through the zodiac, and so you go from in 2,000 years it moves from one zodiacal constellation to the next. And that is the most, you know, the biggest, most profound historical cycle that you can look at in our culture. Though there are other cultures who actually can look at even larger cycles, and in India, in
yeah. And actually, I think it's probably been known even before that, but I know it's been credited to Hipparchus,
right,
in ancient Greece, you know, using all the geometry and stuff back then, they were able to figure it out. And if you look at even that, it's amazing in itself, just using geometry and natural physics and stuff that they had at the time.
And so you have to ask yourself the question, given the fact that the movement that you are charting here in the stars is very, very subtle, it takes, if it takes 2,000 years to move from one house to the next, what kind of civilization would it take to be able to discipline itself to keep records that would basically could describe something like that, could say, this is what's going on. This is, and this is what we can expect for that reason. And the evidence that the mastery that would be required in terms of an organized society to be able just to keep the records that it would take to be able to express this, frankly, I think is great evidence for
the advancement
of ancient civilization. Hipparchus was like, what, about 500 BC or what have you? And yet, there's plenty of evidence that they knew about it long before that. I mean, there's plenty of evidence the Egyptians knew about it, and certainly many other cultures knew about it. And there's some really interesting studies on that score, and I alluded to one of them earlier, but you have to read the book.
I think, yeah, he was 150 BC, if I'm not mistaken. But but to your point, that's actually a good point, because a lifetime back then, life spans were a lot shorter, obviously, for different reasons. But to move 1 degree in 72 years, I think you'd be lucky to make it 72 years back then. So to know that only moved 1 degree in just one person's lifetime, like you said, you would have to keep pretty intricate records and have an ongoing system in place to figure that out.
For thousands of years.
Right. No, I'm right there with you. That's a fascinating thing to me. So let's get to how we know what we know about Atlantis, which is, to my understanding, everything that I've looked into, and I've read Plato's dialogues a bunch in the Critias and the Timaeus, is the two that it's featured in. But I've read most of his other dialogues too, because I try and balance the approach. I know there's some days where I'm like, is it actually Atlantis, or is this just some older civilization that we call Atlantis? And I kind of go back and forth with that myself. It's not that I don't believe in it. It's just, I think if you're being objective, you kind of have to do that once in a while.
I'm okay with it. We use the word Atlantis, and by Atlantis, I'm talking a kind of an archetype.
Right.
Right.
But it could very easily, I'm not saying I'm not trying to identify it as a specific civilization at a specific time and say like a nation or
right
anything like that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There's a lot of stuff built around the word Atlantis too. You know, you got to
Yeah, and you know, when you say that in front of academics too, they're like, oh, they think that you're talking about like flying machines and all sorts of crazy technology that we don't even have now, you know. So but I definitely have looked into it heavily, and like I said, the Critias and the Timaeus are featured there. But the story goes, as I understand it, that Solon went to Egypt and I think Sais, Egypt, and received this knowledge from an Egyptian priest named Sankis or Sakis, something like that, and then brought it back and then passed it down three generations to Plato. And there's some debate whether he was a relative of Plato or if it was a family friend on his mother's side. I think that goes back and forth with that too. But either way, it was passed down three generations to Plato. And then Plato gives us the dating, which would have been 9600 BC, which actually coincides exactly with the dating of Göbekli Tepe. And I'm not making that necessarily.
And the Younger Dryas.
The Younger Dryas. I'm not necessarily making that connection, but I think when you look at this the way that, like, I look at what academics have to say, and they're pretty against the idea of Atlantis obviously being a real or an older civilization like that. But at the same time, I think you have to look at it as a possibility that they knew about these catastrophes and they built mythologies around them. And we all know about oral traditions and how they're pretty actually reliable when you look at the Aboriginal oral traditions and some of the other ones found around the world, that they've been able to preserve some of these myths. And so again, I think that there's something to all this. I definitely think that there was an older civilization that might have gotten wiped out. I'm not saying they were more advanced or whatever, anything like that. But this idea that there was something happening back then and people were getting around a lot more, and then that was preserved and, you know, passed down, I think that that's a definite possibility. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I think that you get to the reason for the book, because there is you have to look at Atlantis as a kind of a presence, you know, as a, or as what Joseph Campbell would have called a myth. And a myth doesn't mean it's not true, or it certainly doesn't mean that it's not true spiritually speaking. It has meaning. And it's something that we share, and it affects all of us. And you have to, if you can look at everything that's going on in terms of our own civilization today, and you look at things that, and the kind of the drama that we've gone through for thousands of years, you can see, you can detect a presence there, an overshadowing presence that is basically kind of directing. You can see it's taking things in a particular direction. I think that in drama, there's this factor that you have to take into account that certainly the Greeks knew about when they devised their own theater and an initiatory scheme, is that they're talking about the way that the soul is basically learns about various conflicts and so forth that it faces. And there's a process that we go through in working our way out of this. And Aristotle, for one, wrote about this, is these are essentially like laws of theater, laws of drama. And they're basically, it's been described as metamorphosis, or the change that the soul is trying to go through in terms of addressing the circumstances in which it finds itself. And there's certain patterns that occur over and over again. And the reason these things happen is in this regular recurring way, is this is something that we have to confront. It's something we have to address, take it in, and we have to learn its meaning before we can ever be free, and which is the objective here.
Yeah, to your point about myths, though, I mean, I agree, because even to this day, we're creating mythologies. Every day we create mythologies because we're relying on our flawed memories, we're relying on our perspective, which could differ, you know, dramatically to the next person. So we're creating these stories, we're creating these mythologies on a daily basis. So I don't think that that's, you know, we learn mythologies in school where it's like, oh, the Greek gods or this or that, and you just assume that it's this fake thing. But there's a reason why those things were created. There's a reason why those stories were told, and it meant something to the people at the time. Where now you look at like what's going on with like UFOs and UAPs and everything that's in the news, and we're creating mythologies around that. I'm not saying that there's obviously not real things in the sky or anything, but we're putting narratives to it. That's what we do as a species. We just put narratives around things and then live the, and play those things out like a story, or like you're saying, like a drama.
That's right. And you know, if you really want to understand what we're going through and you want to address it, you have to look at it from that perspective. You know, if you just try to treat it as a kind of like objective scientific exercise in say, or a debate based upon hard evidence, then you're going to miss the point. However, I do think it's worth remembering, and one of the things we try to do, and there is a lot of hard evidence, but one of the reasons that hard evidence doesn't get properly considered is because of all the weight of the mythologies that that are have been created where people have a vested interest in that. And, you know, they're trying to people fashion narrations that where they like the outcome.
Right.
Where they're trying to basically make it work out in a way that makes sense to them. It may not actually make sense if you can look at it with real objectivity, but that's motivating people, and you have to discount a lot of what people say for this reason. But the process that's going on is real. That is something that we're all involved in, whether we like it or not. And I think Atlantis is as good a name as you can have for the overall scheme of things.
Right. And that's that was another reason why I liked your book too, is like you mentioned, you weren't really assigning Atlantis, and you have all this physical evidence for exactly what Atlantis was. And it's this, it's more of like an archetypal type thing in applying it to, a, you know, previous civilizations and what they went through at the end of the, you know, the last ice age and the transitions, whether they happened dramatically fast or even slower than we imagined. I think that that would be traumatic in a lot of ways. The everything's shifting, and, you know, it's new to a lot of people, and they have to figure out new ways of life and new patterns and all that kind of stuff. So, it definitely has had an effect on us. When you look at, like we mentioned, the impact hypothesis, and you mentioned Robert Schock's coronal mass ejection, do you put weight into one more than the other? Or I guess I know when we had Randall Carlson on, we also talked about volcanism. We did a few episodes on super volcanoes. And if you look at, you know, what Lake Toba, that eruption, and some of even the more recent eruptions, not even that long ago, had a huge impact and would raise or lower the temperature 10, 15 degrees, which would have a massive impact. And even the Lake Toba thing, I think they said after the Lake Toba eruption, there was a bottleneck where only 10,000 people or 5,000 people survived that.
I don't know that particular story, but and as far as which scenario I give the most weight to, I'm trying not to have a dog in this fight. I definitely respect Robert Schock, and Robert Schock has been one of our biggest, most consistent supporters over the years, wrote many articles for us on many subjects. And if he says there's science there, I basically respect it. I've always thought that the impact personally, I feel like the bolide is... That's the direction I lean in, but I'm not disregarding what Robert is saying by any means. And I do think that there's certainly, in either case, the aftermath was very similar. And you have basically civilization struggling to survive in the wake of something that was really terrible. And I think if you look at like the underground passageways and caves in Turkey, for example, and a lot of those places,
Derinkuyu,
Darren Kuyu and others are basically tell you, and nobody can date those things. They all try to, the conventional wisdom is they try to say, well, it must have been done by the Romans, or that's
yeah,
that's absurd.
Yeah,
but they were, whoever came along with the Romans undoubtedly used what they found in terms of those existing caves, but those underground structures and all the multi levels and the rooms and the capability of looking after livestock and all of that, this was immense. I know Robert wrote a lot about that for us in terms of the significance of that. And here you're talking about uparts, you know, that term, the out of place artifacts, OOP.
Yeah.
Where conventional wisdom simply cannot account for the existence of something that we know is so. And the result is that the mainstream basically tries to ignore it because they really can't confront it directly.
You have a lot of stories too that back, you know, you have the Epic of Gilgamesh, you've got Noah's Ark, you've got Yima and Navara, you've got, I mean, it just, the list goes on and on. Yeah. You can go through most cultures and find some sort of catastrophe myth or great flood myth, or, you know, there's, it just goes on and on. You know, like I said, I think most cultures or ancient cultures have one.
Absolutely. And of course, this is all essentially the catastrophist argument. And the mainstream tries to convince us that history evolved, natural history is uniformitarian.
Right.
That what happens, what we see going on right now in terms of the pace of events, this was something that this is the way mountains were raised. It was a process that took, and the only way we can, to cover the time that it would have required, we have to create these vast cycles of long, extremely excruciating long periods of time. And even then, it doesn't really work. But the thing that really does work is the fact that there were immense catastrophes that interrupted life on Earth. And this is how we came to get amnesia, because the interruptions were so catastrophic that we simply couldn't deal with them without having to take extraordinary means and to creating a society which could enforce the kind of forgetfulness that we all insisted on.
Why do you think that the mainstream doesn't believe in all this, you know, kind of stuff? Like, in the sense that they're pretty against the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, they're pretty against the coronal mass ejection and a lot of the other theories, even supervolcanoes, they're like, yeah, don't worry about, you know, like stuff like that. So it's like, why do you think they do that, given the fact that these things have happened many, many, many times throughout Earth's history, and we have the records, the geological records of these things?
It's very threatening. You know, it's very, and that's again part of our point, is that there's a component in all of this in terms of a defensive component, and they're basically defending their own position, power structure, and they're basically they don't want to embrace within that things that would cause the whole enterprise to be easily upset. They want to believe that life on Earth has been relatively stable, and for it to not be stable is the alternative. Is it stable or it isn't? And if it's not, and you start to think through what that means, it's a big deal, and it's one thing to kind of talk about it casually, but it's another thing to actually, you know, embrace what it really, really means.
Right.
And it's scary. It gets to be very, very scary.
So well, it's more than just rewriting the school books.
Oh, yeah. They've got to do a lot. You know, the school books are written the way they are to preserve their narrative, which right. is basically keeps everything predictable and under control.
The other thing is we've dedicated parts of different astronomy departments, and you know, we have professionals looking for near Earth objects. We have professionals looking for unique things that could be approaching Earth. I think just something just passed by a couple of days ago that was the size of the Eiffel Tower that just passed by Earth. So it's like we know these things happen. We know in the past that they've definitely hit. You know, I don't know if you've seen that documentary Fireball: Visitors from Another World. Which is a Werner Herzog documentary, but if I you should definitely watch it if you haven't already, because it talks all about like meteorites, and it goes through all a lot of like the ancient Aboriginal mythology surrounding these things, and like the spiritual context of people have been looking at the sky forever and looking out for these kinds of meteorites and meteors and asteroids and all that kind of stuff.
I know Herzog. I didn't see the one you're talking about, but I have. He did another one that was very interesting back in the '60s about following the production of an opera in the Amazon in the area there. And I've forgotten what it the name of it, but he's definitely someone who is. Who's recognized what we're talking about, and the subtext that is beneath the surface of a lot of narratives that the culture embraces, and how they're really set up or they're programmed in a certain way to protect certain interests. And to keep everybody in step, but because there's this off-kilter nature of it, you know, to be able to preserve that disequilibrium, you end up with a flawed, crippled structure, and that's where we find ourselves.
I think that movie's called Burden of Dreams.
Yes.
So when you look at, you doing the Atlantis Rising magazine for a while and talking to all these researchers and everything, and, you know, all the researchers that you featured and you talk about in your book and in the magazine and stuff, all kind of have a similar idea of this thing. And it's considered alternative, but, you know, there's a lot of science behind it too. Like you mentioned Robert Schock, and this guy's a geologist, and even his redating of the Sphinx, and you know, even mainstream has a huge issue with that. Now, when you look at that kind of stuff, do you ever get like a lot of pushback, or do you ever get any like negativity from that, or is that something that, you know, just kind of, you know, people are interested in that kind of stuff or they're not?
Oh, you mean within my own mind?
Well, I just mean like, do you ever have like academics like reach out to you saying this is wrong or anything like that? Or like I said, is it just kind of...
I didn't, but you know, I had my theories about that too, because I think that their policy toward stuff like I'm promoting is basically to ignore it. Because I think there's a general, from my point of view, I would say, well, sure, they ignore it because... to do otherwise is at their own peril.
Right.
And basically they don't want to challenge the system that gives them all the benefits. And they don't want to, it sounds like a very simple idea. And I guess people are, there's a lot of nuance to it as you look at it in more detail, but I think it really does boil down to people are basically defending their turf,
right?
In one way or another, and of course, when it comes to academics, they're defending a position because they are invested in it, in terms of their entire career, and even things that they weren't personally involved in, that were just kind of developments over, say, 20 or 30 years. They're nevertheless, they do identify with the outcome, and they're, it's like a John Anthony West used to talk about how they're cheering for their team,
right?
and they want to be right, and they want to get the prize that goes with being right, but they're definitely willing to. It's clear to people like us that they're cheating, but right. they would say not so, but.
Right. I would point out too that the reason why I actually brought that up is they were promoting, I don't know, there's some new show, I don't know if it's on Discovery Channel or History or one of these channels, where there's this woman who's a volcanologist, and then this other guy came up with this show, and they're going to go look for Atlantis based on volcanic activity and this kind of stuff. And they, when they posted it on Twitter, it was just amazing at all the academics that just jumped on it. They're like, this person, this is terrible for archaeology. This is terrible for, you know, this and that and the other. This is the worst thing. And then they went through, you know, why, you know, like I mentioned before, though, I will say that from reading the dialogues and understanding how Plato used allegories, whether it's the allegory of the cave, or if you want to say Atlantis was an allegory of a real civilization from a long time ago, or whatever you want to say. I could see their point, because there are things that do point to it being not necessarily a physical place or some global advanced civilization. Like I could understand that aspect of it, but they're so aggressive about it, and they're so not open-minded about the fact that there was potentially older civilizations that had been wiped out or had amnesia or whatever. They immediately point to, like what you were saying before, they want physical proof of a physical place that correlates exactly to what was written down, or else it's not real. And I don't think that that's how you can approach this. And that's again why I appreciated your book, because that's not how you really approached it either. But I mean, what do you think about that, though?
Well, I think that they're they're not playing fair, and they're making demands that are not for how the process is going to be played out. That basically is essentially stacking the deck from their to their advantage, and they're not really looking at it objectively. And I think that it becomes very clear that they're not being objective, because you can see that they haven't been they're not sticking to their own rules, and they violate their own rules. And basically, you can tell that they're, when it comes to keeping their opposition at bay, keeping them down, they're willing to. There's no limit to what they would do to enforce this. That's my subjective opinion.
Yeah.
What's going on?
If you did have to, you know, put a physical location based on everything you've researched, like let's say you had to pick a place, if you thought Atlantis was a real physical place, where would you have put it? Like, or where would you have thought it was?
Well, I don't identify it with a particular place, because right. I tend to think of it more as, I think the real case is to be made for some kind of worldwide order that existed, that basically, and that there were players involved in this drama all over the world. After all, the ocean was, you know, hundreds of meters below where it is now. And so you're talking about vast coastal areas that were part of this regime, or part of this. And I think it was probably benign and loosely structured, and not, if you look at the story from the priest at Sais, you get probably what appears to me to be a pretty one particular scenario of how that order might have unfolded, because they have a very political type of story in there, where they're talking about the 10 tribes of Atlantis and how they warred against each other, and then the war with Greece and so forth, all of which appears to have a political dimension.
Well, that's one of the things that's pointed to too, is why it's not a real, it was an allegory, is because Athens is in there, and how did Athens, how was it around that long, like 9,600, you know? Like
yeah,
years?
There are parts of it that are hard to explain in terms of specific events. But I think when it comes to Atlantis itself and the surroundings of Atlantis, he was pretty darn specific.
Right.
And had a lot of detail and a lot of very extraordinary facts that he was very precise about.
Right. Yeah. And also, I mean, we've talked about when we had Randall Carlson on, and I know we've come to this conclusion a long time ago. When I did think it was a physical place, I put it either at the Azores or near the Azores. There's a convergence of three plates, you know, plate tectonics there. Mm-hmm. So if you were looking for some sort of, you know, event that happened that might be at the center there. And they have a mythology, I think, on the Azores too, of how at one point it was a lot, you know, the basic level of the islands now used to be tall mountain peaks, and, you know, there used to be a whole other structure of land there and stuff like that too.
Well, I'm okay with that. And it's like, if you're looking for the closest connecting story to the physical description that Plato gave, I think that to me, the Azores makes a lot of sense, Canary Islands, all of that. And I think there's certainly a lot of evidence indicating something that kind of the vector of civilization traveling from the Atlantic into the European continent and so forth during the time of the ice ages. And something like that, I have no problem with that. I'm open to it. However, I think in the Bahamas and in the Caribbean and so forth, you have a lot of very, very interesting dates as well that kind of corroborate, like the Edgar Cayce description of things. And so I think probably both had part of it. And I think there are others. I mean, look at India. And the Gulf of Cambay
and Dwarka and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We actually, when we had Dr. Gregory Little on, he shared some of his underwater photography from when him and his wife were down there taking pictures.
Bimini?
Yeah. Bimini Road and, you know, those structures. And I know the mainstream will say, oh, that's just natural erosion, you know, but there's some things there that,
oh, yeah, they're not.
And then there's that other, there's those other structures near Cuba, which they can't really explain. I know his theory on that, and I don't know what your take is on that. It's called like the Cuban underwater pyramid or whatever.
Yeah, I know.
His take was that those were leftover structures from like the Cuban Missile Crisis or the Cold War. Those were maybe structures that were just pushed into the water afterwards or something like that. But I know that they're so deep that nobody's even really been able to fully check them out.
Right. They're about 2,000 feet below sea level, and it's kind of hard to understand that in geological terms. But I think that it certainly sounds like there's something down there.
Right.
But they pretty well dropped that subject as far as mainstream archaeology is concerned. There was an initial flurry of interest, and National Geographic was involved, and so forth, and trying to remember the name of the woman who kind of led the charge on that. But and there are other examples. I mean, look at Indonesia and the Pacific. And there's we touch on all of these in the book, as you know.
Right.
If you look at any one of, if there was just one of these, but there's a bunch of them. And they all have a story that conflicts with the mainstream narrative.
Yeah, I think that the most interesting thing to me about all this stuff is if you look at, after the end of the last ice age and everything, you know, the water levels rising, after the Younger Dryas, you had all these land bridges, Sundaland, Doggerland, all these land bridges that connected, you know, different parts of these continents together. Now, I don't understand why they aren't excavating those.
Wrong
because
bridge.
Yeah, even if you don't believe that there was some, you know, advanced thing or whatever, just the fact that you could probably find evidence of pre-human civilizations or a lot of other stuff that would be interesting, I think, to normal archaeologists. That's why I never understood why they haven't done more underwater excavations on those sites.
Well, you know, I think that in the case of Rama's Bridge, which was that connection between Sri Lanka and mainland India, where there has been quite a bit of study on that by some Indian archaeologists, and the movement or the vector of civilization, as we've called it, you know, it moves from the east to the west. And I think, frankly, Atlantis actually might be the story of what happened in Dwarka. I mean, it's fairly close. Dwarka is a coastal city of India that was basically after the tsunami in, what was it, 2004, I believe that was the year, right? It suddenly exposed a lot of underwater structures, and these are hard to explain. I know I'm rambling on here.
No, I mean, there's so many underwater anomalies and things that have been lost to time and erosion and shifts and different, you know, things. It's just, like I said, that was awesome. That was my whole premise, though, is like you would think that there'd be more underwater excavating going on, considering that, you know, some of the if you look at like the way we think about history, like on land and the way we dig up things and, you know, dinosaurs and different things, that you would find more of that happening, you know, underwater, but I don't know.
That's where the bodies are buried.
Yeah.
Are you a scuba diver at all?
No. Years ago, when I was a lot younger, I used to do a little, not scuba, but I used to do a little snorkeling, but that's about as close as I got to that.
I've always been interested. I'd like to try it.
We'll send Maurice out there as a field correspondent.
Yeah.
Well, we certainly, you know, our story that I mentioned in the book is the way we started all of this was we had an adventure that we thought would be make a good movie that involved a lot of underwater exploration for in the Bahamas, and that leads to the discovery of the ruins of Atlantis.
Well, that's the archetype when you're a kid and you're watching cartoons or some show, right? It's this underwater in a bubble civilization, and they send out these little, you know, boat things, and they can go up and down, and you know, it's kind of interesting in that regard that's how people have always thought of it. When you really read what Plato said, it's like so far from that. But how did it get to that point where we're talking about underwater bubble civilization?
Well, this is more of the Edgar Cayce kind of idea, but. Look, if you think about the underwater, the ocean as being a metaphor for the unconscious, the universal unconscious, and that therefore, and this is, again, central to the theme of our book, is that we're basically all in this kind of adventurous exploration, seeking for the secrets of our origins, the secrets of our birth, and we're looking for it in the bottom of the ocean where it's been cast. I mentioned the story of the Titanic as being a good example of this kind of theme or this kind of idea where you had the product of an advanced civilization, you know, that runs afoul of the will of the gods and is basically cast down to the bottom of the ocean. And this is the, and it's a kind of, you can see this theme of a kind of a judgment day, a rejection of the arrogance of a civilization, just like in the days of Noah, and just like in the Atlantean, this is the theme that keeps coming up in all of these stories, is that basically civilization lost its mind. It basically was resorting to a lot of evil, or it was using the powers that it evolved in for no good end. And Casey talked about that idea a lot. And I think that you have to, and if you combine reincarnation with all of these other things we're talking about, which I do very much, then that's where you start to see the connections between all of these things. You start to see how, okay, the people who were there in Atlantis,
right,
they're us. And we're the reason we're affected by all of this is because we're dealing with our own history in one way or another. And so we're sensitive to these things, and whatever it was that we went through that caused this amnesia the stakes become very high, and it becomes very personally important.
Mm. No, I mean, the message for sure, it should resonate with people. And I think that, again, I don't know how you can look at human history with all its ups and downs, and I mean, we've really only been who we are for the last 200-300,000 years. So to not think that there's been cataclysms and super volcanoes like Lake Toba and all these different events and possible asteroids and comets and stuff, I mean, it's just foolish to think that that can't happen again, or that hasn't happened, or whatever the case may be. So
that was what the priest said to Solon. You know, there have been all of these destructions of in human history, sometimes by fire, sometimes by water, but it's happened many times. And that the Greeks themselves were just children, didn't appreciate the ancient nature of the story of life on Earth. Hmm. And advances and falls.
What about this idea you were mentioning, like it gets to this point where there's like an evil, but what about the idea that everything's just supposed to be in balance, and that maybe, I don't know if you consider or ponder panpsychism, the idea that everything has some level of consciousness, or that maybe the universe has some level of consciousness and that particles are potentially conscious. But this idea that maybe we get to the point where, you know, we do something and it's become this thing that we're out of whack or something, and that needs to be reset. You know, is that something that you've ever pondered?
Well, yeah, I don't have any trouble with that. I mean, I basically think that Rupert Sheldrake, who is very much an advocate of panpsychism and so forth, but the idea of a conscious universe, I don't see how that contradicts the idea that there's an unfolding design that can be comprehended in human history, and that it gives and that this was something that you have great prophets who understood that on a deeper level than most of us do, and who gave us a sense of what was to come, basically just as, you know, observing the unfolding of natural processes.
Right.
I'm not trying to say I'm looking at the, there's some of old man in the sky basically pulling strings, or and that it's natural law across the board. I can see all that we're talking about in terms of natural law.
Yeah. I guess to that point, it's like, I'm right there with you. Like, I think everything, I like reading mystical and mysticism and all these kind of things. But like, when I look at, like, when we're talking about wise people or older prophets or things like this, I think of those as just people that had the knowledge of the things that we're talking about now and could predict things. It's like somebody, Thales, or who was it? Thales that predicted the full moon, and people were like blown away by this. But it's like, if you have the tools and you can, you know, look at the natural world and like predict things like that, then you can start applying it to the bigger picture stuff. And then you become kind of like what we're talking about. You can say, oh, we got to be careful. This is a possibility. And then when it happens, it's like, oh, this person knew, you know?
Yeah. I think that, you know, who was it? Arthur Clarke, who was saying that any sufficiently advanced culture is indistinguishable from magic. And he was trying to make the point that, you know, as we evolve, you know, we unearth and discover things, and things that suddenly give us powers that were incomprehensible to even us at an earlier stage of the game.
Right.
But now suddenly we find we can do these things. And frankly, I would only say that I think that process, we're still just looking at the surface of it. Mm. We're still just looking at a superficial aspect of it. And it's a lot deeper than that. And frankly, I think that there were great wise teachers, avatars, if you will, who achieved a level of understanding and mastery of all of this that we still don't understand. It's beyond our capacity to understand, because it awaits the day when we too can pass the test that they passed. Mm. And learn. And so we're all kind of like in the waiting pool at the shallow end of the pool.
Mm.
And that the deeper stuff, the real action is going on at the deep end. And we're at the shallow end, the consequences of our action are revealed to us very quickly,
right?
But they're not as serious. And at the deeper end, carrying my metaphor a little further here, at the deeper end, the consequences take longer to unfold, but they're more consequential.
Right. It's interesting. Well, listen, do you have time to do like a 10 or 15 minute Patreon with us for our patrons?
Okay, sure.
So let's wrap this up here. This was a pleasure. Everybody go check out Douglas's book. I have the link down below to Inner Traditions website, Ghosts of Atlantis. I read it. It's highly recommended, especially if you've been listening to our show and you like all the the speculating and the theories and hypotheses regarding all these ancient civilizations and Atlantis and Plato and all that kind of stuff. So I highly recommend it. Again, the link is down below. And yeah, thank you so much for, you know, sharing your time with us and sharing your thoughts. And do you have any final little words you want to add in here?
I can't think of anything that I haven't already said.
All right. Sounds good. I think you laid it all out there.
I appreciate that.
Well, listen, again, it's been a pleasure. We'll have to get you back on the show sometime in the future, because I think that we could go a lot deeper with this as well. But yeah, thank you so much. And we appreciate everybody. And we appreciate everybody that participated last night in our 200th episode, which was amazing. Thank you so much, everybody. And again, one more time, we're about to do a Patreon with Douglas. So head on over to patreon.com/mindescapepodcast for just $2 a month. You'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments. And there's a bunch of stuff up there, so just go check it out. And one more time, head on over to indrasweb.org. It is live. This is a social media platform that we created to connect open minds. So if you're not familiar with the analogy of Indra's net or Indra's web, go check it out. That's the whole point of this platform, is to connect people and come up with good ideas. So head on over there and Absolutely. Start an account. So thank you so much, Douglas. We love everybody. Stay safe out there, and we'll catch you next time. Peace.
Peace.